This We Love Telly podcast is a Mirror Digital production. Hello, I'm Rob Lee, and joining me on this week's We Love Telly podcast is Renaissance man Omid Jalili, who is going to be talking about his relationship with telly, how it nurtured and scarred him with Jim Will Fix It as a youngster and also Play School. And Omid has quite a surprising insight how X Factor Act Two Shoes may have been instrumental in bringing down Colonel Gaddafi. So let's get right to Omid. Joining us now on the We Love Telly podcast is multi-award-winning stand-up international film star and acclaimed writer-producer of all things theatrical and telly. He's on tour all over the UK and Ireland until the end of February, and you can find more details by following him on Twitter at Omid9 and OmarJalili.com. It's, handily enough, Omid Jalili. Hello, Omid.
Lovely. I'm overwhelmed. You said you're going to put on a radio voice, but that's a force of nature.
That's some pretty efficient introducing as well, isn't it?
That's amazing. But hang on, you, there's only one Twitter address. Did you mention two Twitter addresses?
No. It was your Twitter address and your web address.
Yes. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's my job over. So now it's over to you to entertain us. Of course.
I've got to try and be funny, and I'm on the clock, so I'll.
Okay. We'll invoice you later. So, inarguably, television is the greatest art form we shaven apes have ever created. And for you as a young lad, it was indeed the way you came to fundamentally comprehend the world, wasn't it? I'm thinking specifically about Play School here.
Yes, how do you know about Play School?
Oh, I've done my research. I've looked at Wikipedia, I've done all that.
I couldn't speak English. my parents lived in this country, as you would, you know, if British people live abroad, they'd speak English with their kids.
Mm-hmm.
My parents spoke Farsi with their kids, so I got confused because I went to nursery school and everyone spoke English and I didn't speak English, even mm-hmm. though I was born and raised here. So he started. I think the nursery school said Play School. Let him watch Play School. So I used to watch Play School from the age of 3 or 4, and I was just fascinated by the round window, because it used to be they'd tell a story through, you know, the square window or the.
Mm-hmm.
I just became completely obsessed with anything round. And then I had no idea that I would, in a few years' time, become a sphere myself, overeating. So I think that's how things are ingrained in your mind when you're a child.
Round window was indeed your first word. It's almost like a kiddie-winkle synonym for television itself, isn't it? More pressing than acknowledging mum or dad or chips or anything like that.
Television, yes, I think it was everything. But for me, I think my introduction to comedy, actually, was through Derek and Clive. I was given a friend of mine who was given a Derek and Clive Live album.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go around to his house after school when we were like 13 and absolutely wet ourselves laughing at this. I'd never heard anything like it before. And then within a year, I'd also discovered Cheech and Chong. A friend of mine who was at school, I think his dad was a session musician with the Rolling Stones, who'd given him a Cheech and Chong record.
Uh-huh. So
Cheech and Chong and Derek and Clive, I think, were the two big comedy influences I had. So it really wasn't even TV. So even when it comes to stand-up comedy, I didn't really know what that was. I was introduced to that when I was about 28, 29. So it completely passed me by. All that kind of 1980s Ben Elton. I remember thinking Harry Enfield was very funny,
mm-hmm.
with his loads of money. And I did watch Saturday Night Live, and whenever Ben Elton would talk, I'd think, this guy's, you know, what's he doing? He's incredible. He just talks and people laugh. So but it was really those comedy albums, I think, were introduced to me. Well, not so much even TV. I didn't really laugh much at TV. It was really comedy albums, I think, that got me into comedy. But that really wasn't even... I'm just trying to be entertaining.
That's a dangerous introduction when you're a teenager. Cheech and Chong as well. And that illicit album of Derek and Clive as well, with all the swearing.
Yes, I think anyone in their 40s, that was their first introduction to comedy. It was so naughty. Some of my favourite bits can't be repeated on the radio. But,
of course.
I'm glad you know where I'm coming from.
Your kids are on the way to being all grown up now, but were you keen on letting them watch TV when they were young? Going by their ages, I'm sure their formative TV experiences must have been around the time of the Teletubbies, something like that.
Yeah, they television was something that I know some families have banned televisions, and I don't think it's a good thing. It's just like any kind of social media, I think it all depends on how it's used. I think if television is on all the time, you know, I used to joke about that in my stand-up. I'd say, you know, Victorian times, you know, I never understood when you come in and someone's got a telly on, and people are just talking, but the telly's on. It's like in the old days, you know, in Victorian times, there just used to be a vaudeville act in the corner, going, you know, just kind of going, roll out of the barrel.
Or an evil conjurer or something like that.
Yeah, could you just turn it down, please, because we're talking. We'll just switch it off, don't have it on, kind of thing. So I think television is used... is used in the correct way. Like I'd always tried to watch good stuff with my children. I mean, certainly mainstream television, things like Frasier, more upmarket sitcoms. And I think it's actually influenced them. I think it's influenced their viewpoint in life. Because if like a computer, if you put good stuff in a computer, good stuff comes out. You put trash in a brain, then you get trash. So I think that I've been very vigilant to make sure there were all the things I like. I mean, there's a great joy as a parent, isn't there? You sit down. I never forget, last year I sat down and watched Amadeus with my kids. They're all musicians. And I said, just watch this, you know, The Life of Mozart. And it was just a tremendous, and they absolutely loved it. And of course, there was a young Cynthia Nixon in that as well, which got, they all got very excited. Because, oh, that's Miranda.
And you starred with her, obviously, in Sex and the City too.
Yeah. And actually, that's how I got brownie points. I said, I'd just seen Amadeus. He said, you're the only... second person ever to point out that I was in that film.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's...
Oh, yeah. So big brownie points for me.
And on the Fraser Crane aspect, you've alluded before that he's one of the greatest living characters that you can aspire to. So what are your kids, all moving over, off to Seattle to become psychiatrists or something? Or?
No. Actually, interesting, my daughter is 18. She's at film school right now. And it's interesting that the films that she has to study... she came home the other day. She had two films. I thought, just out of interest, what were they? She went, The Godfather and Scarface. I said, what do you think of The Godfather? And she watched it. She said, yeah, it's a little bit slow, a bit boring. And I said, what do you think of Scarface? She went, oh, amazing. And she goes, I had no idea that, you know, terms like say hello to my little friend. This is something that her kids would say, but they wouldn't. That's what her friends would say.
Uh-huh.
But they wouldn't know where it came from. So she got very excited that all these things are in popular culture. The kids say now came from that film, and say hello to my little friend was one of them. So I quite like it that she preferred the 1984 Al Pacino to the 1975 Al Pacino in The Godfather. Yeah.
And she's the coolest because she knows that where the etymology of all these phrases is from. So that's good for her.
Yeah.
So still on the whole formative experiences kind of aspect. Towards the end of October, you tweeted about Jimmy Savile. About how you'd asked him to fix it for you to play tennis with John McEnroe, nothing had happened, and then he fixed it for somebody else, and hence your career in showbiz. TV really has nurtured you and scarred you, hasn't it, Ahmed?
Jimmy Savile was somebody who always disappointed me, because I used to write him constantly. I just wanted to play tennis with John McEnroe, and he never... And it's a special kind of hurt. You know, there are certain kinds of hurt that you have, like, you know, you've asked to play tennis with John McEnroe, some pipsqueaks doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Can't even play. It's a special kind of hurt also on Twitter, I think, to see that Yoko Ono is following 700,000 people.
Really?
But not you. That's a special kind of hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think that Jimmy Savile did that to me, and I never forgive him for that.
What are you going to say to Yoko next time you see? You're going to really ball her out, I suppose, since she's not following you.
Please fix it for me to listen to one of your albums. Without cringing.
Maybe Yoko Ono could take over Jimmy's... Actually, I think they've got Shane Ritchie at Christmas fulfilling a special Fix It special. But maybe Yoko Ono, that'd be a real kind of cross-cultural bonanza, wouldn't it?
That's amazing. What a thought, Rob. What a thought.
Well, this is why I should be in, you know, commissioning, really. I mean, so that's...
But
anyway.
If I had my TV head on, I probably would have come up with the funny gag there. So I'm so sorry. I'm just still adjusting my head to... This is a TV podcast. Apologies to everyone listening.
Not a problem. So again, on Twitter, earlier in November, you tweeted a couple of times about Ricky Gervais, once when you were gigging in Reading, and you said that's where Ricky's from, he's born, and once when you were in Leamington Spa performing at the Warwick's Arts Centre, and again I made another link with Warwick Davis's success on Life's Too Short. Bearing in mind the whole Hmong debate, which was raging on Twitter, and the response to the show itself, has Ricky Gervais lost it, do you think?
Not at all. I mean, I've so far only seen the first episode. I thought I did tweet that I felt that the Liam Neeson scene is one of the best things I've seen in that genre, which is basically bringing in A-list celebrities to make fun of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought what Liam Neeson did was hysterical. I think one of the best bits was, let's do the improvisation, you know, you're a hypochondriac. So Ricky goes, say, you, not again. And he goes, what's that? He goes, well, you're a hypochondriac, come and see me. He goes, no, I don't want to do that. He goes, well, that's what you say, because I don't take notes. Let's start again. And for an actor to say, I don't take notes, is such an outrageous thing to say. I thought that was hilarious. I really thought it was funny. I haven't seen, I'll be catching up on it later on. I'm not aware of what the reaction has been. I certainly enjoyed the first episode, so I can't really say. It's funny, I'm not aware of those things. Some people think there's a media storm created. I did see Ricky tweet something about those are not reviews, they're just personal attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what happens. I think, you know, people have, you know. I do a show in Cambridge. People are laughing from beginning to end, and there's a standing ovation, and then that is reviewed as a 2-star show in the Independent a couple of days later. So you just take it with a pinch of salt, really. I'm not really, I never pay too much attention to reviews, if that's what you're talking about when it's television review. And television reviews, by the way, for television comedy, by and large, are very snooty at the very, very best. I've rarely seen a comedy, I think, since Gavin and Stacey that was well reviewed. Most things are pretty poorly reviewed, and it's difficult because it's a balance between having critical success and then numbers, especially if you're on the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
They're very concerned about numbers.
And certain newspapers aren't very fond of the BBC anyway, are they? So
they're not fond of the BBC. Everything. If you're on the BBC doing comedy, you. I was warned when I had a BBC One television show, don't expect great reviews. And as it was, I had some very good reviews, and then some bad ones. Then some that said, oh, your stand up. Then none of them had to go at the stand up, which is interesting. They just didn't like the sketches. But then, since then on Twitter, everybody says, oh, we love the sketches. Can't you do more? So I actually think a lot of the critics get it wrong, or there's a big discrepancy between what the people think and what the critics think. And I think that as a comedian, you really should be going more with what the people think than what
mm-hmm. But you've also been one of your own harshest critics. You're in you had your own HBO special about 6 years ago, I think it was 2005, and of course you were in Whoopi for 23 episodes a couple of years before that. Now, I've seen that you said the HBO special, you said you felt like a charlatan, and obviously you've had your own two series of the Omar Jalili show. How do you pinpoint TV success then? If it's not the reviews, you go with the people, but as your own harshest critic, what do you determine as your own TV success?
It's difficult. I think if you can, for me, TV success, if you can watch back what you've done and laugh. When I say I've never even watched my HBO special.
Really?
I've never brought myself around to watch it, yeah. I think because
it's still showing on demand in the US, by the way.
It is, and it's apparently doing quite well, but I've never watched it. We were a batch of comedians, one of whom, rest in peace, you know, Patrice O'Neill, who passed away. It was myself, Patrice,
mm-hmm.
Louis C.K.
Kevin Pollock?
Was Kevin Pollock one of them?
Yep.
Can't remember.
Yep.
I can't remember all of them, but I do remember I went to watch a couple of them, and they were just superb, and I didn't see myself in that league of comedian at all. But I think that if you can watch back something you've done. I mean, I've watched back a couple of things I've done, like an episode I did with on Black Books with
yeah.
Bill Bailey and Dylan Moran.
Yeah.
And I watched it and I laughed. I hadn't actually seen that episode. I did it 11 years ago. I did that,
mm-hmm.
and I saw on Twitter people watching it. Oh, this is so funny. So I then recorded it and watched it one night and laughed. I thought, hey, that's really quite funny. So if you can watch yourself back and laugh, certainly as a comedian, then I think you're doing okay.
So what kind of TV comedy is floating your boat at the moment? I mean, there's a second season of Phone Shop, which in my opinion has come back very, very strongly. Still Fly to the Conchords. What kind of stuff is floating your boat?
I must say, first of all, I like the word floating your boat.
Well, it could be stroking your boat, but I didn't want to make it too intimate. We haven't met properly.
With your radio voice, what floats your boat? I love it. It's just making me smile inside.
Jolly good.
I've been a big fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think that's very well documented on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
I've been following the eighth season very, very sharply. But I think when people are such fans of a series, you don't laugh out loud the way you do. You kind of giggle. So it's. I would say whenever I'm watching Curb Your Enthusiasm episode, like four, the one with Ricky Gervais was very funny as
very
well.
Good,
I
yeah.
just watched that. I don't. I kind of laugh. I just go, oh giggle. I say, oh giggle.
You don't lol. You oh giggle.
I just go, oh giggle. Or yeah, I only lol if something is like a European thing. I go, oh Euro lol.
What would made you ruffle then, or lamau, or even pumicle?
I have to say, Jerry Seinfeld made me laugh a lot. He was at the O2 recently. It's funny, because I know Stephen Merchant was doing about to do a tour same time as me. So when all these people like Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock, when all these people at these big gigs at the O2, I was there, and I always saw Stephen Merchant there. I thought, you're touring next year? I went, yeah. So we just go and get inspired. I certainly thought Jerry Seinfeld was much better than I thought he was going to be. And also Larry David's stand-up makes me laugh a lot. We had a great conversation. He was in the Paul Reiser show that I did, and we were talking about our worst ever opening lines. And I think Paul Reiser said one of his opening lines was, he'd get the audience to ask, who invented sarcasm? And they'd ask him, who invented sarcasm, Paul? He'd go, I did. You know, like sarcastic. And then, but Larry David said he said, I had a line, but it never really got a laugh. Should have. You know, because he's really into it. He really had committed to his style of comedy.
Yeah.
He's like, because I really think black people never really gave slavery much of a chance. And I said, what? He goes, yeah, did it work? Did it get a word? Did it get a laugh? He went, no. And I think because they didn't get his irony.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You've got to be really into comedy to find that funny, you know. So, but I think he makes me laugh. But again, with people, you have to know them. I found that whenever I tour, now that people know me better, they laugh more easily.
Well, that's a basic ingratiation thing, isn't it? When people are eager to impress, they laugh more readily.
Yeah, I remember seeing Jack D come out of the Celebrity Big Brother house in his first gig back at the Comedy Store, and he got a 1 minute standing ovation. I'm sure he'll remember the night he came out, and his opening line was, yeah, you clap and laugh at me now, but you didn't pick up the phone to get me out of there. just got a massive laugh. So the people, he'd gone up a notch in people's estimation, and they were watching him and they loved him. So he didn't even have to say anything funny. He just by appearing, and now he was funny. Of course, he was funny. But I'm saying that there's a comfort in knowing someone. You're more predisposed to laughing when you know them.
So are you saying that you haven't made it until you've been on a reality show? Because that handily links to my next question. Because it must be noted, there's been somewhat of a come and get me plea vibe in some recent interviews they've done towards the bosses of Strictly Come Dancing. This is all about the belly dancing, isn't it, Omid?
Yes. First of all, I love the way you segued into that.
Seamless.
You seamlessly went from Jack D. But where you were wrong was that you assume that that success is gauged by being on a reality TV show, and that's not necessarily the case. I have also never made overtures towards wanting to be on Strictly. I have been offered to do this dance for Sport Relief.
Okay.
I have to. I would like to do it because it's for charity. But I think it's, I'm so heavy, and I've already had three knee operations only because of dancing too much by being overweight. It puts so, for every 1 pound that you are overweight, 4 pounds goes through your knees. So I would do it to try and lose weight, but I'd have to get doctor's advice about supports and all that kind of stuff. So there is actually a real danger. I may never walk again.
Well, that's quite a good reason not to do it. But you're nowhere near as heavy as some of the guys that have done it. Russell Grant, Audley Harrison, and the last series alone. You're nowhere near the size of those boys.
No, but I think it's a proportional thing. I would like to do it. I think it'd be a fun thing to do. I think it's, you know, people who do that, I do appreciate that it's all game for a laugh and they're doing it for charity. And if you get in the right spirit, I think where people go wrong is if they take it too seriously.
Okay.
That kind of thing, you just can't take it too seriously.
Now, on TV Heaven, TV Hell, you've previously fingered Brideshead Revisited as your idea of TV Heaven. Are you a fan
of... I fingered.
You fingered it. Yes, you've. I'm very careful with my words. There's no subtext
enough,
there.
Obviously,
it's very lovingly, appropriated. Are you a fan of Downton Abbey, or is it too soapy a watch for you to satisfy your period drama requirements?
I'm ashamed to say I've never watched it. I would like to, but it's always been on while I've had a tour night, so I've missed it, and I would like to catch up on that. But if it's anything like the old Brideshead Revisited, I was a big fan of the book. I'm a big fan of Evelyn Waugh. I've read all his books. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably because I failed English A-level about five times, so I went through the whole syllabus, and I've read every single one of his books. But that series was iconic, and it was, if Downton Abbey's anything like as good as that, then I'll definitely watch it on iPlayer.
Okay, and for the last question.
iPlayer is BBC. Downton Abbey is...
ITV player, yes.
Exactly, ITV player, sorry.
Now, obviously, I can imagine you're a huge fan, and this is a very important part of the interview, but I'll leave out the fingering terminology. But
I'll keep it. I love the fingering. It's great.
Well, maybe not by the time I finish this sentence, but who's your pick for the winning act of X Factor, Omid? I'm sure this is praise on your mind all the time.
Well, I have to say I'm a big fan of Misha B.
Okay.
She's got a great voice. I also like the two Scouse lads. They're very good. We're down to the last four, aren't we?
Yeah, there's Marcus is left, who's one of the Scouse lads, but Craig has now gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The guy with the very heavy side parting has gone, and we've got Marcus, who to me is more of a kind of a musical kind of actor. I think he's very special, but
yes. Okay, well, I think it's between Misha B and the rock chick. Was it Amy? What's her name?
Amelia.
Amelia, excuse me, Amelia. I think Brian Adams made it very clear that he liked her.
Yes, he did, didn't he?
I love the way when they asked him, "Do you have any advice?" And he kind of said. Did he say learn an instrument? And he says do lots of live. I can't remember what he said. Like write him songs. He said, which I think was a sideways swipe at the whole concept of the show, which I thought was good. But Amelia, I think she's got a great voice, and she looks like a star too.
She belts them out.
I think they've all got careers. To be honest, I think a lot of these people. I mean, when we were up in Leeds, Two Shoes had just gone out, mm-hmm. and they had a gig. They're taking away all my audience. They're Two Shoes doing a gig next door.
So
Two Shoes, who were the first people to get kicked out of the live final.
So would you like to take this opportunity to declare war on Two Shoes? It's a great line. It's a killer headline, Omid.
I know, you're just looking for, you're just waiting for me. You're talking about fingering. You're doing all kinds of things just to get a massive headline out of me. Omid Jalili wants to kill Two Shoes.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you very much.
Omid Jalili wants to kill Two Shoes. There you go. There's your headline.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
What makes me laugh, because that's what they did when Gaddafi got killed. They did that on the New York Post. They just had a picture of this kid who had Gaddafi's golden gun, and he was wearing a baseball cap. And the headline says, Gaddafi killed by Yankees fan. The Americans were taking credit for killing even Gaddafi, just through a headline. So do what you like, mate. It's yours.
I thought you were going to say Two Shoes were instrumental in the downfall of a Libyan despot then. Now that'd be quite
that's
some insult.
Headline. Two Shoes responsible for Gaddafi's death.
Right, well, that's my headline. Thank you very much for joining us, Omid Jalili. This We Love Telly podcast is a Mirror Digital production.